Oh, hey, how are you?
Great to hear.
Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable.
Like a drink?
Sure.
There you go.
Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tech Lounge with me, Christian Schiller. So I am very lucky to interview all sorts of interesting people on this podcast. And a lot of the time, it's people that are doing new things. But every now and then, I also get the opportunity to speak to sort of more legendary guest, someone who's been around the tech and computing industry for some time. I've had a few throughout the years, including people like Stephen Wolfram. Yes, that was a little while ago now, actually. And today is no exception. I have an interview recorded live whilst him and myself wandered around the venue outside. And there's a little bit of background noise, which I've done my best to clean up, with the infamous legendary Dave Thomas, whose quite legendary book, The Pragmatic Programmer, still educates developers 20 years later. And of course, he has taken that further to the Pragmatic Bookshelf Publishing Company. We have a great, quite long talk for this show, so please do enjoy. Before we begin, there's just a few people at the door who've got some things they want to tell you. Then we can get stuck in. If you'd rather not hear these interruptions, then please support the show. You can find details in the episode and show notes. Many of you might have heard of Descript because it's been around for a while, and it's probably one of the first tools to let you edit audio and video like text. Delete text, edit text, and the audio and the video update to reflect those changes. Getting rid of ums and ahs, mistakes, repetitions, etc., etc. Has a lot of other features which I also use on my podcast and videos, like interactive transcripts, AI voices, summaries, show notes, chapter markers, all sorts of things. So if you would like to give Descript a try too and get a discount on a paid plan and earn the show a little bit of money too, then head on over to go.christianschiller.com/Descript. Let's begin with let's start with your journey into the programming world generally,
I think. Oh, Lord.
As far back as you want to go.
It goes back dinosaurs, really. So I started coding. I was in secondary school in England. And the way the exams worked, we had something called A-levels.
Yep. I took them myself.
So I took a bunch of them a year early. And so I finished doing all the tests, and they happened before the end of the school year. So I basically, they ran out of things to do with me before the end of the year. So they said, do you want to try an experiment? The technical college across the road has just started teaching this thing called programming.
Yeah.
And they're looking for guinea pigs to go and take the course. So I said, oh yeah, sure. And so I went across the street, and we were sitting in one of these temporary huts, and learned how to program in BASIC.
BASIC, okay.
And
there's a rough date on it then, I think.
It was 72.
Okay, yeah.
And I fell in love with it. It was just like, I was gonna go do math at somewhere, and instead it was just, it just suited me, you know? And so I switched, I went around and found a university that was gonna do computer science. There weren't that many at the time. So before I did that, I got a summer job programming a local water board's computer, and then went up to college, and I was incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
It was their second year, so they were still feeling their way. And so we got to play with so much stuff. It was absolutely amazing. And then from there, I started a PhD, but honestly, I felt kind of like I would much rather be doing real things, you know? Got a job with a startup, and again, it was just a programming shop.
Yeah.
And so they would say yes to anything. And so I got to experience so many different environments, so many different projects.
Yeah.
And that was it, just like, you know, continuing programming and things associated with programming, yep. you know, for the next, what is it, 40 years.
So at the Ruby event, we can get to that in a minute, but you know, did you have any languages in those early days? Because there were some in addition to BASIC, of course, but that you really connected with?
Oh, that's actually the subject of my talk tomorrow. Okay, right. But yeah, there's a bunch of them. I actually, to do this talk, I went back and I thought through the languages that changed me. You know, the ones that actually had a big enough impact, they changed the way I thought about programming and sometimes thought about the world. And some of them are surprising. Mm. So some of them are fairly obvious. We did Simula in college, which is arguably the first object-oriented programming okay. language invented in the mid-60s.
So before, because that was like Smalltalk, wasn't it?
Sorry, what, sorry?
Before Smalltalk then?
Smalltalk was a little bit later.
Okay.
But yeah, Smalltalk was like 74,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
And Smalltalk was influenced by Simula.
Okay.
But so Simula had features that were totally different for anyone who's been programming back then. Mm. Just this entire idea of encapsulating data and things together, classing, all of this kind of stuff was just brand new and mind-blowing. In fact, Simula still has ideas that have not been adopted today. It's really quite revolutionary.
Yeah.
But it's also remarkably ugly, so it's part of that. So that kind of thing changed me. Surprisingly, we did a course in computer numerical control of machinery.
Okay.
And to do that, we learned a programming language called APT, A-P-T. And that's used to control...
She sounds vaguely familiar.
Milling machines and things like that. And the cool thing about, the reason APT changed me is that you don't program it by saying, go to location, you know, 2733, move the head to location, whatever. You define a geometry in terms of constraints.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, now follow the outline of that geometry. And that, again, was revolutionary. It was, you didn't program it directly, you programmed it by intent.
Yeah.
And that was interesting to me.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting how there's a lot of things. You look at some of the research from organizations like Bell Labs or the Douglas Engelbert videos, even some of the kind of stuff out of Xerox and things, and you look at some of them and just think, how did they come up with these ideas and how... We have this tendency to just think that everything we do is new.
No, see, I have a theory that, because I was thinking about exactly that.
Yeah. Right?
Why is it that some of this older stuff appears to be so much wilder than the stuff we're doing now?
Yeah.
And also, when you consider the resources they were using, incredibly ambitious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
You really had to know what you were doing.
You did. And I think, actually, to some extent, the resource limitation plays into that, you know? I think you are forced to focus so hard on what it is you want to get done that you produce something which is minimal and expansible at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
But I think also they were not working under the burden of 50 years of this is how you do it, you know? And so they were free to say, okay, I'm going to do it. One of my favorite examples of that is there's a language called PIC, P-I-C, which is part of, so Unix, Bell Labs, they needed a documentation system, like man pages and stuff. So they produced this program called Nrof, which is...
I just finished reading a book on them, and that does ring a bell.
So Nrof was the thing they used to do man pages, and it's basically you type in text, and then you put formatting by putting like dot something.
Yeah.
You know? And they extended that so they could write academic papers with it.
Yeah.
And then they called it TROF.
I think I know
it was the type
where this ends
version.
Up, of course. Yeah.
Right. And then one of the cool things about Unix, of course, is this idea of pipelines, where you can take the output of one program, feed it to the next. Well, it occurred to them that they could take preprocessors that took in some other thing and then converted it to trough, yeah. and then feed it through trough, and then, and so they had a whole bunch of stuff, and so much of it survived today. Like EQN, which is the thing that does equations, is the basis of all of this math jacks and online math and everything else. Whenever you see someone typing math with a backslash in it, that's EQN.
Yeah.
And then it came through as, well, it came into LaTeX and the stuff like that.
Wonderful world of LaTeX. I love LaTeX, actually.
Anyway, PIC is a drawing language.
Yeah.
And PIC is gorgeous because, again, it is declarative. You don't specify the locations of things. You just say how they are in relation to each other. And PIC is a really, really open, user-friendly language. You can do things like, you can say, box with northwest corner at 2 inches to the east of the last box's southwest corner. Yeah. I mean, almost in those words. And it just does it.
Yeah.
And it's written in one file. And it's not just written in one file. It's actually written using a compiler called Yak. And all of the program exists as side effects of parsing the GRULs. It is brilliant. Absolutely. Like it's a nightmare, but it's brilliant, you know? So all of those kind of things, just like, they're so inspiring, you know?
How many of these are still possible to experiment with? I mean, you can do quite easily spin up lots of virtual machines these days, but whether they exist is even some of the later... like interpreters for the Choose Your Own Adventure engines and things like Activision and stuff, it's a struggle to get virtual machines because of copyright issues, because the code is not available. Like, hey, how many were you actually able to still experiment with?
Oh, most of them.
Okay.
Yeah, you can find, there won't be the originals often. So like PIC, I think you can get the source code for PIC, but the Free Software Foundation has GPIC. And then there's one called DPIC and Picture, and there's a whole bunch of variants. But you can also find, one of my favorites is, you can get a PDP-11 emulator.
Yep.
Emulates the hardware.
Yep.
Right? And I've got one, you can buy a kit, actually from a guy in Germany, which is a two-thirds scale PDP-1170 console, right? And it is beautiful. I mean, it really is. It looks just like the original with all the lights and all the switches.
It's almost like a Raspberry Pi in it, doesn't it?
It's got a Raspberry Pi in it. And not only does it have a Raspberry Pi in it, it emulates the PDP 1170, and you can boot up RSX and RT11 and just run all the programs. But not only that, they actually had to slow it down.
Yeah, this is the problem. I tried some game emulators, and it's the same thing. You know, like Sonic the Hedgehog, for example. That's not even that old, but you know, when you played it, it was amazing. And now you put it on an emulator, it's like slow down. The computer is like aeons ahead of what anyone expected it to ever run on. So
I mean, all of these pictures you see of the, you know, the old computers with the tape drives and everything else. I mean, your phone has got like more computing power than the entire planet in 1970.
It's crazy, some of that stuff. But
that's, I think you're right that we there is so much that we, if we just stop running forward and just look behind us every now and then, you know, we would learn so much more.
I think this is an interesting conversation to come into the sort of other side of your professional life when we come to sort of education in a minute. But I'll try and remember that train of thought to come back to. Let's kind of fast forward to sort of why we're here. I would imagine in your career, you probably never really necessarily stuck to like one language for any reason beyond interest or job or whatever. But what put you to Ruby and why?
I view languages very much as tools, but also as kind of partners in development. Mm. It's kind of a weird relationship. I expect a language to perform for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I will do my best to understand it and make sure that we do the right thing. So I'm always experimenting, right? I'm always like dipping my toe into different languages to see what I like. So at the time, it was 1990s. And I was predominantly writing, I think back then it would probably be C. Probably just C++ at that point. And at the same time, I was downloading new languages and trying them.
Yeah.
And back then, downloading a language, you use something called Usenet.
Yep.
And you would download a multi-part thing, which would be like 50 separate files, which you would then join together and then run them through a program that decoded them back into a binary. And I would typically download two or three, maybe that's too many, one or two a week. And just play with them for like an hour.
Yeah.
And typically it would be, okay, yeah, another one of these. And I downloaded one I came across called Ruby. And I was absolutely blown away. It had so much of the things that I liked about, say, Smalltalk,
yep.
but in a way more accessible manner, you know? So I played with Ruby for a day. I played with it the next day. I phoned up Andy Hunt and said, hey, you got to play with this. This is really cool. And this was, we were just finishing up the Pragmatic Programmer at the time. And so it didn't, there may be a reference to it in the original, I can't remember, but it didn't really make it in. But I kept playing with it after that, and it became my kind of personal language of choice. So for all of the things I was doing that didn't involve a customer, I'd be writing Ruby code.
Yeah.
And it basically just grew from there. I got involved with the so-called Agile movement.
Yep.
And I evangelized Ruby to those guys a bit. And I think that helped spread it a bit.
Yeah.
I wrote the first pickaxe, put all the documentation from the pickaxe back into the Ruby source code so that all the functions were documented. Met DHH when he was still a young lad at the back row of a conference in Denmark. He was actually he was there as a helper and got talking about Ruby. And I mean, he already knew about it, but that was kind of interesting to bump into him and then come across him again 3 years later. And then from there on, it just like kind of became my language of choice.
Yeah. And we talked earlier about these sort of fascinating languages from the past, and maybe my slightly more modern mindset doesn't necessarily remember how long they were around for. But languages and technologies have their ups and downs and their heydays, and they're cool, they're not cool. And, you know, Ruby is not necessarily at its peak cool anymore. But 30 years is a reasonable time to still be used to a fair degree. What do you think has contributed to that longevity?
So I don't know if there are, I think different languages have different life cycles. Mm. So there are languages that flare, you know, come up, go down, no one ever sees them again. Like Objective-C, for example. You know, that was the darling of a whole, like, well, if you take a generation, that's meaning 2 years, a whole generation of developers, you know, that was like the new hotness.
It was out of choice, but yeah.
it was going to be the language of choice for Apple and that died, whereas C, for example, still going strong. COBOL is more, until recently, it was the most used language in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Different languages have different characteristics. Ruby's characteristic is, if it wasn't for Rails, it would be, you'd be looking at it and saying, wow, look at that language. It's done. It's been still going around, and it's been growing steadily year on year. What happened was that Rails came along. People jumped on the hype train. Everybody fell into Rails. Not everybody stayed.
Yeah.
And so what we see is a decline because of that. But the reality is, I think if you look around, 700 people at this conference, Ruby is still going strong.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it suits people. And it's really hard to describe what that means. But it very much, it's a tool that lets you find ways to express yourself without dictating too much.
Yeah.
And so you find yourself when you're writing Ruby, if you are a writer, then you spend a bit of time trying to find the right words, the right phrasing, and the right structure for your phrase. You know, a paragraph has to flow a certain way. Yeah. When you write Ruby code, you can do the same thing. You can actually look for nice ways to express things. Not just a way, but you can experiment with nice ways.
Yeah.
And that means that you get a really quite nice creative buzz from writing the code.
Yeah.
You feel that you've done more than just turn out code.
Yeah.
But you've produced something you can be either proud of or interested in or whatever else. Yeah. You know? And it also means that over time, you can evolve your style. So I find myself, the Ruby I'm writing now, totally different to the Ruby I was writing 10 years ago, totally different to the Ruby I was writing 20 years ago. Very, very, I mean, fundamentally different code, same language. Mm. And that's powerful.
Yeah. So it's still your language of choice?
For some things, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the language I reach for kind of by default.
Yeah.
For most, now I'm not writing enterprise level software, yeah. You know, but I am writing software for my own business and I'm writing software for myself. And for the day-to-day stuff that I do, Ruby works best.
Okay. Yeah. It was a little bit in the past for me. I think these days I tend to, just because some of the projects I've been working on I had to and then I just carried on. It unfortunately tend to mostly lean towards TypeScript these days. Just because I did a lot of VS Code plugins and you kind of do, and then a lot of other programs these days are, and then so you just end up kind of sticking with it because half the time you're forced to, so you just carry on.
But right.
In the past I used to do more Ruby, actually. Back in the days, it probably sounds terrible, but when I did a lot more with Jekyll, actually, was when I used to do more Ruby. And then I kind of moved away from Jekyll. But
I'll be honest with you. I mean, you ask, is Ruby my language of choice? Yes. Mm. But it's not a hill I'll die on. You know, I tend to distrust programmers who say, I'm a Java programmer.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I write.
Yeah.
I would be very happy if someone said, I'm a programmer and currently I'm writing Java.
I'm a pragmatic programmer.
But yeah, the language is simply a way of expressing, right? I think whenever people become religious about something, you know, whether it's a language or a technique or a technology, then they blind themselves to all the other things they could be doing.
Yeah, I think you're right too. On that kind of subject, you know, what do you think the language, does the language need to do anything to survive another 30 years? Are there things that are drastically missing or shortfalling? Or
Absolutely. I think the idea of programming is undergoing a fundamental change. And I don't necessarily mean all this AI stuff. Mm. I think that the idea of writing a program to do something will be seen as fairly quaint
in
10 years.
Yeah.
I think that we'll be looking at writing, I don't know what the word will be for it, modules, nodes, whatever, that all exist in some kind of cloud and that all interact through means unknown. I don't think we'll be writing as much as orchestrating.
Yeah.
And it has to be that way because as code becomes more complex, the idea of us trying to manage the whole thing ourselves is crazy. We won't be able to do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think for a language to work, there are languages I'm looking at now. My current favorite is a language called Unison. Unison.
Oh, Unison.
Unison, as in, you know, all together as one.
Yeah. Unison, right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't have source code. Well, it does, but you throw it away.
Yeah. There are also weird ones. When we were back in Melbourne for my mother-in-law's 80th birthday, I went to a talk and someone did a talk on, I think it's more of a proof of concept language, the Mindfuck or Brainfuck or whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And they were showing how to write Hello World in it. And it was...
It was the most
ridiculous thing ever. And it took like 3 minutes to run. But as a conceptual talk, it was amazing. So let's maybe switch to the, I don't do this more often, the other kind of side. So a lot of people know you from a particular book, but there are books, I think. Why did you feel that was a necessary thing at the time? And it's a while ago now, isn't it, I think?
Pragmatic Programmer, if you're talking about that, was 90... We started it in 97, I think. So the history of that book is that Andy and I were doing consulting.
Yeah.
And we would go see a team, and the team would complain that their builds wouldn't work consistently.
Yeah.
You know, and we'd have a look at it and discover that, like, the build instructions were two sheets of paper.
Yeah.
And no one ever followed them. Yeah. Exactly. They would complain their software didn't work, and we discovered there was not a single test inside.
Yeah.
So we kind of got a bit sick of telling people, you know, to do all of these what we thought were obvious things.
Yeah.
So we started putting down, like, oh, I guess you'd call it a white paper of notes that we could give to our clients.
Yeah.
And my wife said, you know, you should make that into a book.
Yeah.
So we were kind of like, oh, no, I'll be interested in that. But to test the waters, we came up with a cunning plan. We were going to send the draft first 100 pages or so to what we considered to be the best publisher of books in our area, which was Addison Wesley.
Yep.
And they would, of course, turn it down, but they would give us feedback, which means we could then, you know, make it better. And
oh, how publishers have changed.
Bastards accepted it, yeah. So there went that plan. So that was really it. It wasn't like a big mission from God. It was just like pragmatic, I guess.
Yeah. I sort of wonder with some of the things you talked about, like, it's actually crazy to think, was that 30, also nearly 30 years, I guess. What am I talking? I don't know, I'm losing myself. Sometimes the 2000s feel like it started yesterday. It sometimes feels like, this kind of comes back into the earlier thread, that I've, you know, people like you and I who studied engineering at universities, you kind of got taught certain procedures and patterns and processes and things. And then a lot of kind of modern education comes kind of the more sort of hands-on practical side, and that maybe some of those pragmatic principles get lost a bit. Is that, you think that's, is that just old men shouting at clouds?
No, I think actually, I'm not too sure I'd agree with the characterization of it. I mean, I'm all for shouting at clouds. I mean, yeah. that's fun. But I'm thinking back to my education, and it really was remarkably practical.
Yeah.
We were programming. You know, there was at least one class of hands-on programming a day.
Yeah.
We were doing all sorts of stuff with hardware. We were writing compilers, all this kind of stuff. I think, well, the interesting thing today, if we wanted to compare education systems, is that nowadays, I don't think CS degrees teach people programming. And I look at I just to see what it was like, I actually went and became an adjunct professor for a couple of years just to see what was going on. And the students that came to me, these were third and fourth year students. And when I said to them, okay, your coursework is to make these tests pass, they were literally, what's a test?
Okay,
you know?
That stuff doesn't really get taught, does it? Yeah.
They don't, they are really not taught much about practical programming. They leave university and then they have to learn.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas I think, and that's possibly because the topic now, the subject is so big.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was learning it, you could actually know most of computing, you know, one person.
You didn't have all these levels of abstraction. Mark, right. You know, so many levels of abstraction now.
Yeah, when I were a lad.
Bare metal is all there was.
Cardboard box, mate. Cardboard box.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Okay. And when did the book become kind of a publisher? If I'm assuming, is that kind of a full-time thing? Or is
it was. No, what happened was we published a book and we were still consulting. And then there was a, I don't know what the word, let's call it a slowdown, post year 2000.
Yeah.
And kind of the bottom dropped out of consulting for a little while.
No, that's where I started working. So yeah, sorry.
Right. So, and we were looking around for sort of various alternatives. Meanwhile, I'd just finished the first edition of the Ruby book.
Yeah.
And that went to Addison Wesley. And it occurred to us, we had done all of the typesetting and layout and everything else for those books.
Yeah.
Just being the kind of people we are. Mm. So all we were really missing, this is what we thought, all we were really missing was connection with a printer and stuff. And that turned out to be actually pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
So we decided to put together a series of three books, the Pragmatic Starter Kit, which was version control, unit testing, and automation, which we thought were kind of like three legs of the tripod of a good team. And we would publish those ourselves. And we did, and it went relatively well. And at that point, we already had the infrastructure in place. And then people came and said, hey, can we write a book? And we went, oh, sure, join the club, you know. And it kind of grew from there.
Yeah, and you do seem to put out quite a bit. I'm on the newsletter. So, I mean, from then let's kind of wrap up with a, we talked a little bit about the future of Ruby, sort of postulated about some of what the future of programming might be. Is it, what's the kind of the future, looking from a, your publisher perspective, your consultant perspective, your speaker perspective, whatever you think gives you the most insight, what do you think the trends, the current trends in technology and programming will survive the next 30 years?
Oh, Lord.
Two or three.
Well, I think you earlier mentioned engineering as a word. And I honestly don't think that what we do is engineering. And I think we are still in the... There's a really, Glenn Vandenberg has this really gorgeous talk about engineering. He talks about bridge building.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And we are still at the stage where back in the Middle Ages, people built bridges and they would over-engineer them because they had no idea what they were doing. And then gradually, because that was expensive, they'd, you know, chip away here, chip away there until the bridge fell down. And they go, oh, too far. And they'll add things back in. And then maybe once every 100 years, someone invents something really cool, like the arch.
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly we go through the whole cycle again, you know. So if you look at bridge building as a as an exercise, until we started getting finite element analysis, it was pretty much all it was all kind of art rather than science. It was, this is how we've done it, right? It was experience. It wasn't amateur. You know, you could go and you could order a bridge and you'd get a bridge. But it wasn't backed up with anything approaching theory. And then along came the theory. And then we start seeing some wilder bridges, you know. I think that we are not yet in the theory stage. I don't think I mean, at some level we are. We understand, like, you know, formal grammars and this kind of stuff, we can do, if we wanted to, in theory, proofs of correctness of certain kinds of code.
Yeah.
But we are not yet at the engineering phase where you can go and you can get a book of tables and know that I can put this in here and this and I will have a working system.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm looking for is an evolution towards that phase.
You could almost, I mean, if used correctly, you could almost say that this kind of current trends with the new waves of AI, I don't want to say AI because it existed for decades, could potentially provide that, but I don't know if that's what anyone's going to want to use it for.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. Until AI becomes, it's really interesting, they call it generative AI.
I know, this is
but it's exactly the opposite.
It's the terminology, the other episodes of the podcast, we kind of dig into two topics, and the last one that I think just went out, because I scheduled it for 12, I think, was around, like, I remember studying AI at university in the early 2000s, taught by professors from the 70s. Like, it's not new.
No, no.
And the terms we're using at the moment are not really correct.
I mean, it's what we're doing right now is basically n-gram analysis.
Yeah.
You know? And it is all based on matching historical patterns.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
So if you are looking to innovate, then the only way you'll do that with the current generation of AI is by letting it make a billion mistakes and then somehow having a fitness function that says, oh, this one's better.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think we're going to see AI produce engineering for us.
Yeah.
I think what we will see is AI will make it a lot easier for people to produce software for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of what I'm hoping, especially someone like myself who is semi-amateur at most. And sometimes I have ideas and I just get, then I get frustrated because I don't really know how to implement them.
Right.
And it will start me on that way. And what I have been very good at is looking at code and tweaking code. Starting it from scratch has always been a struggle. But if someone gives me code, I can look at it and improve it and fix it and move it around and change it. And that is potentially one of these, I don't know, I still come from a generation where it doesn't feel like the first step I should take, though. I still feel like I should go and read a book and learn.
I think computing is something that is best learned by doing.
Yeah.
But be efficient when you're doing
it.
Rather than sit there and floundering around and trying, you know, every single possible key combination until you find the right one that works.
Yeah.
Use whatever tools
it takes.
The tool
can tell you.
You know? Historically, that was cut and pasting off the web.
Yes, exactly.
Now it's cut and pasting out of Claude. You know, I mean, it's just different aspects of the same thing.
And coming very much back full circle to the beginning as a nice wrap up, I think I'm about maybe just under 10 years behind you in my programming journey. And I do remember my first experiences were not copy pasting. They were copy reading,
typing
from magazines. And invariably there was a mistake. And then you got frustrated and went out and played football instead. But it was, you know, we've always kind of copied from each other. It's just the techniques have got smarter, you know.
Right. Well, see, and that is the interesting thing about software compared to just about every other discipline, and that is the cost of manufacturing is zero.
Yeah.
And in the old days, it was very close to zero. I mean, what was it? Dr. Dobbs every now and then would come with a floppy disk, you know, to save you having to copy the stuff off the page and type it in. And that was like 20 cents or whatever it cost them to do that. Nowadays, it's whatever you pay a month for your internet connection.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Anyway, this has been a fascinating conversation. I feel like it could go on much longer, but you have to come to an end at some point. Otherwise, we turn into two old guys rambling, which is fine.
That's what we are, actually. I have to talk about honesty. How about that?
Yeah. And unfortunately, even myself, I start to find myself the oldest person in the room, which is depressing. But anyway.
Oh, you got nothing on me.
I didn't think we're that far ahead. But yeah, cool. That was really interesting. Yeah, there was many different paths I think I would have liked to have gone. I think I've been digging deeper into the past recently for various reasons. And, you know, it's sometimes easy to forget it, especially in the computing where you just think everything is new. And it's not true. Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. I really appreciate it.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.